Vasudeva placed the female child on the bed of Devaki, bound his legs with the iron shackles, and thus remained there as before. Next text. Exhausted by the labor of childbirth, Yashoda was overwhelmed with sleep and unable to understand what kind of child had been born to her. Purport. Nanda Maharaj and Vasudeva were intimate friends, and so were their wives, Yashoda and Devaki. Although their names were different, they were practically non-different personalities. The only difference is that Devaki was able to understand that the Supreme Personality of Godhead had been born to her and had now changed into Krishna, whereas Yashoda was not able to understand what kind of child had been born to her. Yashoda was such an advanced devotee that she never regarded Krishna as the Supreme Personality of Godhead, but simply loved him as her own child. Devaki, however, knew from the very beginning that although Krishna was her son, he was the Supreme Personality of Godhead. In Vrindavan, no one regarded Krishna as the Supreme Personality of Godhead. When something very wonderful happened because of Krishna's activities, the inhabitants of Vrindavan, the cowherd men, the cowherd boys, Nanda Maharaj, Yashoda, and the others, were surprised, but they never considered their son Krishna the Supreme Personality of Godhead. Sometimes they suggested that some great demigod had appeared there as Krishna. In such an exalted status of devotional service, a devotee forgets the position of Krishna and intensely loves the Supreme Personality of Godhead without understanding his position. This is called Kevala Bhakti and is distinct from the stages of Jnana and Jnanamayi Bhakti. Thus end the book to become the purports of the 10th canto, 3rd chapter of the Srimad Bhagavatam, entitled The Birth of Lord Krishna. Om Ajnana Timirandasya Jnananjana Shavakaya Chakshur Militam Yena Tasmai Shri Gurave Namaha Jaya Shri Krishna Chaitanya Prabhu Nityananda Shri Advaita Gadadhara Shri Vasudeva Bhaktavinoda
Hare Krishna, Hare Krishna, Krishna Krishna, Hare Hare. Hare Rama, Hare Rama, Rama Rama, Hare Hare.
Vasudeva has returned to the prison cell in Mathura. He's placed the female child on the bed of Devaki, and he's bound his own legs with iron shackles. So, to the ordinary vision, everything has happened ordinarily. Vasudeva is shackled again. There's a child who's just been born. To your ordinary senses, nothing astonishing seems to have occurred. Vasudeva and Devaki are in prison. It was known that Devaki is giving birth. She gave birth. Everything seems to be business as usual. But one who has the eyes to see understands that an extraordinary event has occurred. The Supreme Personality of Godhead, who is all-pervading, has appeared from the womb of Devaki. What is Devaki's testimony? She prayed that, what is so astonishing that the Supreme Lord has appeared from my womb when he's everywhere? Why should you be surprised? How can God come from someone's womb when God is present everywhere? And then, after the appearance of the Supreme Personality of Godhead himself, he arranged that he be transferred to Vrindavan. We discussed this yesterday. Apparently, the motivation was fear. Yet, the reality is how to increase the love. Because in Vrindavan, the Kevala Bhaktas are there. Devotees who don't even have a trace of jnana. No understanding that Krishna is the Supreme Personality of Godhead. Krishna is going to award his childhood pastimes to them. The next verse switches to Vrindavan from Mathura. Yashoda is exhausted by the labor of childbirth. Overwhelmed with sleep, she can't understand what kind of child had been born to her. Whether it was male, whether it was female. In Vrindavan, everyone simply loves Krishna. They do not care to know that Krishna is God. Sometimes they speculate after Krishna does something amazing. Who could this Krishna be? Gargarishi did foretell that this child would be like Narayana. Maybe he's a demigod. Sometimes they would, just like devotees, gather in the courtyard out there, and they may talk a bit. What about this? What about that? You know, Vaishnava camaraderie. It's like as I was coming to get class, I see Ramaya Swami Aniruddha, Sadhguru's talking. You know, Vaishnavism, you know. How's the service of the Lord going on? Yeah. So, sometimes in Vrindavan also they huddle. And, it's Krishna. What do you think? Who is he? Where's he really at, you know? Like Narayan. Yeah, could be. Demigod. Probably. Just like the cowherd boys, they would have a huddle. And they would discuss after Krishna's done something wonderful. Maybe he's a demigod. But then they came to the right conclusion. If he's a demigod, so are we, because we're just as good as him. All makes sense. Mother Yashoda, inspired by Yogamaya, would sometimes see extraordinary things and begin to wonder, just like when she looked into Krishna's mouth to see if he had eaten dirt. Krishna had defended himself. No, all my playmates, led by Balaram, are conspiring against me. They're angry that I won't play with them anymore. Therefore, they're lodging these false accusations. So Mother Yasoda said, all right, very well. Let me just look in your mouth. That will solve the whole issue. Let's have a little investigation here. I'll look in your mouth. And you know what she saw when she looked into Krishna's mouth. Because Krishna contains everything. It's just that he, with his curtain of Yogamaya, doesn't let the devotees in Vrindavan see his all-pervading nature, his opulences, because it hinders their love. And as we discussed yesterday, Krishna is mostly interested in the best love. So he understands the best love comes when people don't think I'm God. Then they can really be spontaneous, and I can be spontaneous. It's more enjoyable that way. So Mother Yasoda saw the entire cosmic manifestation. She saw herself also. And then she began to offer prayers. Like, just see my illusion. I think I'm the center of the universe. I think Nanda Maharaj is my husband. Vrindavan is my home. She began to wax philosophically. Have a philosophical analysis of life. Krishna let it go on for a short time, and then Yogamaya covered her over. In other words, enough of this. It was an interesting sidelight, but the main thing is the spontaneous loving exchanges. While Mother Yasoda was in a state of bewilderment, wondering what's going on, she went through a logical thought process. Okay, what am I seeing in my child's mouth? She always considered my child's mouth. I'm seeing the entire cosmic manifestation. Now, let's do a checkup here. I'm not dreaming. Oh, no, I'm awake. I'm quite sure I'm awake, so it's not a dream. I'm not in bad health, so I can't be subject to derangement. Furthermore, it cannot be that the demigods are bewildering me. Why? It's quite obvious. I'm just an insignificant woman. What business would the demigods have bewildering me? Therefore, what can the conclusion be? My child has always been a bit different. That's all. And then, inspired by Yogamaya, she just came to the right Yashodamayi conclusion. Oh, just let me love my child. Let me hug him, embrace him. Enough of all these other things. After the Leela of Krishna rescuing Nanda Maharaj, his father, from the watery kingdom of Varuna, there was another huddle in Vrindavan. You know, Vaishnavas, they like to get together and discuss things. So, when the cowherd men heard about how the great demigod Varuna was worshipping Krishna, but more so Nanda Maharaj, still, Varuna indicated, my life is successful upon seeing Krishna. And because Nanda Maharaj is the father of Krishna, he'd also been offended. Varuna put him on a throne and worshipped him. Still, Varuna made it clear, Krishna is the Supreme Personality of God. Now my life is successful. My career as a demigod has reached the pinnacle. I'm seeing you, Krishna, in my watery kingdom. Just forgive my assistants. They were ignorant, dragging your father here. Just forgive them. They don't know what they're doing. But you are here. So then, Krishna and Nanda Maharaj returned. And Nanda Maharaj was telling all the cowherd men, the older gopas, can you believe it? The great demigod, Varuna, one of the major demigods, was honoring my son. So once again, there was speculation. Who is this boy, actually? Bhargarishi said some amazing things. Could he be the Supreme Personality of Godhead? Could that be? If he is, I wonder what our destination will be. Maybe we'll go back to the spiritual world. Here they are in Vrindavan. Maybe we'll go back to the spiritual world, our next life. This is how Yoga Maya keeps everyone covered. For Krishna's pleasure, to make the best love. So, their speculations gave Krishna an exciting opportunity to reciprocate with them. The cowherd men were wondering, will we go to the supreme destination? Maybe the son of Maharaj Nanda can take us there. I wonder what it's like, the supreme destination. So Krishna, being omniscient, knew their desires, and he wanted to reciprocate. You see, sometimes we have this harsh understanding of the Supreme Lord, that here we are serving so hard, struggling with upholding the temple, struggling with applying bhakti in our individual lives, whether we're single or in a family. And Krishna, he's a bit oblivious to us. Sometimes we have a bit of resentment against Krishna. Why has he made the process of bhakti so hard? Doesn't Krishna understand this world of attachment and obligation, necessity? Doesn't he understand that? Why do we have to carry this burden of sadhana, this burden of devotional responsibility? Why can't Krishna just make it easy? Of course, Krishna has made it so easy. Our business, however, is to make it difficult. But we like to blame Krishna. He's the one. We don't want to look in the mirror. All facility, all ease has already been granted. But we are experts in complicating our lives and desensitizing ourselves to the Supreme Lord. That's our program. How to avoid Krishna? How to push Krishna away? You've ever been around someone who doesn't want to be around you? And they show it in a, you know, very, how should we say, discreet but effective way. That I don't want to talk to you. I don't want to be around you. I don't want to deal with you. It happened to me on the plane coming from London to Mumbai. What I do, I reserve the aisle seat months in advance. I know just the seat I want, so you know, I'm not too cramped, and I don't want a window seat, I want an aisle seat, room to maneuver, get out when you want to without crossing over someone. So what always happens on the flights to India is that someone will come up to you once the plane is boarded, and they'll say, excuse me, but three of my family members are over there, and three of my family members are there. Can we have your seats to put the whole family together? It happens every time. And so there you are dressed, you know, sadhu, you know. They don't take that into account, you know, just, you know, family. Three family members here, four family members there. Can we put them all together by using your seat? The very seat you reserved 2 months ago. So, you know, what can you do? You're in your devotee attire. So generally what I do is I just very gently, I say, I'm sorry, but I have this seat for a purpose I reserved a long time ago. I say very gently, non-agitating way. Because I already have my things stored overhead, you know, laptop, this, that. I'm all set up for a productive, you know, journey, you know. My books are all arranged. And then someone comes, can we leave your seats? My family is scattered. And so you really have to keep your cool. So I said that to one gentleman, elderly man. He's probably not much older than me, but you know, if you're not living a devotional life, you look old. So he probably didn't understand that, you know, he's not that much older than me. So I told him, I very gently, you know, please understand that I reserved this seat a long time ago, and it would be very difficult for me to move. He was just wanting to shove me in any window seat wherever, because his family of six members had to be together. So I said that, and then he looked at me and went away, and then he went and got the flight attendant. My family is separated. But not his seat. By looking at him, you know. All right, we'll take care of you. You know how it's done in India, you know, it's real. You really got to control your temper, you know.
My family is separated. This, you know, that seat looks good.
And he watches as the flight attendant looks my way. So then she comes up to me and, you know, squats down, you know.
Oh, sir.
His family is, you know, his family is separated. And wouldn't you like to give that seat to her? I said, no, I have this seat for a reason. And she still sits there and she's squatting down beside me. You think she'd get the hint, you know? But now she goes on and on and on. And meanwhile, the man, you know, he's watching, you know. So she goes on and on and on. And I say, no, you know, I prefer the seat for a reason. Say very gently, because you're dressed as a devotee, you know. You know, you have to be very careful about that. So then she goes away and comes back. Okay, I found a seat just like this, right across there. Wouldn't you take that? So then my only objection was that all my things had already been arranged in the overhead compartments and this and that and the other. So I said, all right, I'll do it if you'll move all these things. So while I was discussing with her, the elderly gentleman comes over, you know, in a way that would be sure to incense anyone. He comes over and says over her shoulder, "And you're welcome." You know, and it looks at me. It's like you're some kind of, you know, sheep or something. "And you're welcome, moving the monster." But such a subtle way. It's guaranteed to just get under your skin, you know. So in this way, he communicated all these things, all this arrogance, but in a very nicely packaged way, very discreet, cultured way. So anyway, I agreed to the flight attendant's proposition if she was going to move everything. So she did that. And as I was moving, of course, the man was watching like triumphantly.
"We know how to use the system."
What can you say, you know? You just have to be tolerant. You know? You would think, being an elderly Indian gentleman, he would understand. You just don't push, you know, someone dressed as a sadhu around. Now, it didn't make any difference. Just another impediment in his way. So, in this way, he actually was skillful in going about his activity. He was skillful in showing his impersonalism. He didn't care. He just wanted what he wanted. Similarly, we do that to Krishna. In our various maneuvers, we indicate our interests come first. Krishna, you're there on the list, but you're way down. And actually, if you would be a bit more realistic about your demands upon us, we're quite sure our bhakti would increase. But because you're so demanding, and because you've made it so difficult to be Krishna conscious, therefore, we're not so forthcoming. And therefore, we have to kind of keep you at a distance. Try to look in your life and see how you're keeping Krishna at a distance in a very skillful, cultured way. You don't want Krishna to get too close, because there's fear you'll be swallowed up by something. When actually, all that happens in Krishna consciousness is that you get swallowed up by love.
That is the goal of bhakti. And that is the Vrindavan platform. Love dictates everything. Even to Krishna. Krishna becomes subordinate. He chooses to subordinate himself to his devotee's love. But we have this expert, civilized, so-called, cultured, sophisticated attitude of how to deal with Krishna in a way that protects our own interests. And then we wonder, why am I not making advancement in Krishna consciousness? We do it in a skillful way, just like the man did to me. He didn't come up to my face and say, why don't you move? No, he got somebody else and he did it from the background, inserted a few, you know, incisive words. Any luck moving in? Like that. So we should look in our lives and see how we do that in terms of our devotional service. And then we wonder, why is my heart not enthralled by the holy name? Why is my heart not enthralled by seeing the deities? When we blame Krishna, of course. I've given everything to you. And just see. You haven't revealed yourself to me according to my schedule. So this is our problem. It's actually impersonalism. It's actually arrogance. The opposite is Vrindavan, where everyone and everything is simply existing for Krishna's pleasure. In Vrindavan, everyone and everything is at Krishna's disposal for his service. This attitude of being at someone's disposal is looked down upon in the material world. This attitude is called Sevan Mukha. I'm at your disposal. That attitude begins, Sevan Mukha Hi Jivada. That begins with the tongue chanting Hare Krishna and taking prasad. By vibrating the holy name with your tongue, by tasting prasad, you become infused with that Sevan Mukha attitude. Yes, let me be at Krishna's disposal. Just think what it's like to be at someone's disposal, beck and call. In material life, it's considered contemptible. No, you be yourself. You shape your life. But in spiritual life, to be at Krishna's disposal, to be at Krishna's beck and call, is the highest platform of life, the greatest love. And the residents of Vrindavan, the Vrijvasi, specialize in that. Not simply the cowherd men, the cowherd ladies, but the trees, the grass, the water, the Jamuna River, the animals, they all act at Krishna's disposal, Krishna's beck and call. Just like when Krishna and Balaram are wandering through the forest. To have a little fun, Krishna tells Balaram that the whole forest is glorifying Balaram. Krishna knows that the forest is glorifying him, but like a good Vaishnava, he wants to give the credit to the other Vaishnava. Balaram, just look at the trees, how they're bowing down at your lotus feet. Balaram, look at the bees buzzing. These great sadhus are so attached to you. Balaram, look at the fruits and flowers when they're touched by your fingertips, how jubilant they are. Look at the deer. Look at the hills. Look at the Jamuna River. They all become auspicious by your glance upon them. So in this way, Krishna is pointing out how the forest of Vrindavan relates to the Supreme Lord in giving pleasure. This is the Sevan Mukha attitude. Everything and everyone is at Krishna's disposal. The more attentively we chant the holy name, the more this attitude takes over us. We shouldn't be afraid of it. We shouldn't be afraid of love. This is a hard one to understand sometimes. Me afraid of love? No, no, no. But we're afraid of being dominated by Krishna. We think we've got a better solution. My program for myself, I know what it is. Krishna's program, I don't know. So you got to go with what you know is for sure. And just keep Krishna at bay. And hope that Krishna won't do anything too radical to your life.
Okay. You think, if Krishna is intelligent, he'll let my life go on as I've planned, and therefore my devotion will grow naturally, just like he's leaving me alone. Of course, he should make me blissful. That should be there. But he just shouldn't upset my plans. He shouldn't upset my vision. We're so tiny, we're so puny. How can we think like that? But because we have this rebellious attitude, we do. But the Sevamukha attitude, which comes by attentive chanting of the holy name, Krishna, I'm at your disposal. That is the desired attitude. And the residents of Vrindavan have that spontaneously. Even if they're in the so-called superior position, Nanda Maharaj, Yashoda Mai, they're Krishna's parents, superior. Even though they're acting in that way, they feel themselves to be at Krishna's disposal. All the residents of Vrindavan feel that way. The gopis, they pray, we're just your maid servants. When will you come back from Mathura and pay us some attention? We're waiting. This is the attitude that we should aspire for. We should look in our hearts and see how much resistance we're building up, maybe, to being at Krishna's beck and call. We shouldn't get desensitized in Krishna consciousness. Many of us, when we were new devotees, we were exuberant and fresh out of the material world, so we were, and whatever, tell me what to do, I'll just do it. But then as you learn the ropes as the years go by, you may become desensitized. Of course, as you progress in bhakti, there should be maturity. An interesting thing, as I've mentioned before, is to seek to combine the enthusiasm of a new devotee with the wisdom of an older devotee. That's the best package. The new devotees, they're fresh with enthusiasm. They remember what it's like to be smashed by Maya. They haven't forgotten the futility of passion. They've been there, done all that for the most part. And so when they come to Krishna consciousness, yes, this is it. But they don't have so much wisdom because of not much experience. Then the older devotees, they've seen this, they've seen that. They have lots of experience. But sometimes they lose their enthusiasm, their freshness. They forget we're dealing with Krishna and Krishna's service, the rarest opportunity. They start to take it all for granted. Yeah, the temple, yeah, the program, yeah, the devotee, yeah. The best thing I found is to pray to the deities, let me combine the enthusiasm and freshness of a new bhakta with the maturity and wisdom of an older devotee. That's the best package to have. That's why in a healthy devotional community, you need both. You need the freshness of the newcomers to Krishna consciousness, and you need maturity and wisdom that comes from the older devotees. Just like in Vrindavan, they have the village elders, Upananda, Nanda Maharaj. They give the wisdom, the counsel. And then you have the children of Vrindavan having a good time, providing the freshness, the excitement. So Krishna does it so expertly that the residents of Vrindavan are always talking about his childhood pastimes. Did you see how he crawled into someone's house? Did you see how he stole milk here, stole milk there? They're always talking like that. Krishna stirs things up with his fresh childhood pastimes. And the elders, they talk about it. What to do, what to do. Should we take away his jewels? Doesn't do any good. His body is so effulgent, he'll still find his way in the dark. They're talking like that. So, in Vrindavan, you see the freshness of infancy and the maturity of the elders. All there in Krishna Leela. We can take good heed from that. How we should aspire, as I said, to have the novelty and freshness of a new devotee combined with the experience and wisdom of the older devotees. And this way, our devotion will be very attractive for Krishna. And that is what life is all about. How to make our service attractive to Krishna. You see, for some time, our devotional service will be based on just getting relief from material existence. But sooner or later, the motivation has to change so that we'll start to develop attraction for Krishna. You can't just go on in Krishna consciousness based on just negativity. I want relief from suffering. I don't want to suffer anymore. Being here is better than being out there. That's okay in the beginning. But after a while, we need to see how is my appreciation and attraction for the glories of Krishna developing. That appreciation and attraction will come naturally if you've had duty consciousness. If you want the raga, the spontaneous attraction for Krishna, first there has to be the duty consciousness. Just like in New York City, on the central post office, there's a mantra inscribed on the top of the building in stone. It's the mantra that powers all the posties in New York City. Neither rain, nor snow, nor sleet, nor hail will stop these posties from doing their appointed rounds. So that duty ethic is what a devotee needs. And when you have the duty consciousness, from there, the spontaneous attraction for Krishna appears. Without the duty consciousness, you get nowhere. Being attached to your duty in Krishna consciousness is what burns away the impurities, the selfishness. Because in order to be attached to your duty, you have to be tolerant. You have to experience being humiliated, sometimes misunderstood. But because you're attached to doing your duty in devotional service, you stick it out, and Krishna rewards you with attraction for him. So let us not pass over this duty stage. A smart devotee is eager to have a duty in Krishna's service. Because he knows, she knows, by that duty I'll become purified. My selfishness will go away. My resentment against Krishna will go away. Your duty protects you from the ravages of Kali Yuga. It gives you a chance to get Krishna's mercy. Because Krishna is watching. How carefully, how painstakingly are you doing your service? It's not that Krishna needs your service, but we need the opportunity to show Krishna how much we care. Isn't that so? Even in an ordinary relationship, the other person wants to see, how much do you really care? Isn't that test always going on? Those of you who are in that situation, you know. If there's a violation in that department, havoc is there. Especially the men, they have a difficult time understanding this. What's the big deal? So what if I forgot your birthday? So what if I forgot what day we were married on? And we, you know, I didn't bring in an anniversary gift. So what? And then the other ones, but this shows you don't care. And the men, they just can't understand. Oh, look, I just slipped up one time. Look at all the other things I'm doing. Look at the nice car I bought. Look at the computer. Look at all the male toys that I filled the house with. This shows I care. So, even in an ordinary relationship, there's this constant question. How much do you care? Do you really care? The senses are always there, taking readings. And if there's any slip-up, all hell breaks loose. So, why, if we're like that, do we refuse to let Krishna be like that? Krishna wants to see, do we care? He doesn't need the service, but we need the opportunity to show we care. That's the importance of duty. It gives you a chance to show Krishna how much care you're going to show for his interests. So a real devotee is eager for that opportunity. Give me a duty. Give me the chance to show Krishna that I can care for his interests. I can protect his interests. That is when bhakti becomes very exciting. Beyond the self-satisfying stage of bhakti. When you are eager for an opportunity, yes, give me a chance to show Krishna that I want to learn how to care for his interests. Then you start to feel some life in your heart. So, Prabhupada writes at the end of the purport about life in Vrindavan. In such an exalted status of devotional service, a devotee forgets the position of Krishna and intensely loves the Supreme Personality of Godhead without understanding his position. This is called Kevala Bhakti. In the sixth canto of Bhagavatam, Shukadeva Goswami explains Kechit Kevalaya Bhakja Vasudeva Parayana Agam Dunvanti Karchanena Niharam Ivabhastra. A few fortunate persons, Kechit, not everyone, but a few fortunate persons, they'll render unalloyed devotional service to the Lord. And that service is like the appearance of the sun that will drive away all the fog. Just by that exclusive devotion to Krishna's pleasure. Now, there's no question of any fog of material desires in Vrindavan, because there, that sun of unalloyed devotion, Kevala Bhakti, is shining so radiantly, there's no room for anything else. We can experience that sun of true bhakti driving away the fog in our life. And that is the realization you need in order to effectively communicate Krishna consciousness to others. You've had that experience when the sun of bhakti rises, then I can see the fog in my life dissipate. When you get that experience, you are ready to help transform others. But first you have to get that experience. And how does that sun of bhakti arise in your life? When you start to consider Krishna's interests and placing yourself at the disposal of Krishna. This sevanmukha attitude, which is so important. It's not difficult. Especially if you focus on hearing the holy name with attention every morning. That's why the Shastra says, Sevamukhi Jivada. It'll all get going by the tongue. The tongue will produce that attitude. And once that attitude starts to awaken, you start looking everywhere for opportunities to serve Krishna. What is the only reason why you may turn down a service? In order to protect other service that you're doing for Krishna. The only reason. I can't do everything at this point. So in order to safeguard this duty for Krishna, I can't do that. That's okay. It becomes very joyful. You're choosing to serve Krishna in the best way. Then life becomes lively.
Or questions?
Yes.
In the way that we can relate to Krishna is holding this out and in his blessing?
After the duty stage.
But in this, the love of yours, the father, we have so much service to us, so when it is not.
Yes.
But also, in what case would we relate to this?
As Krishna's humble servants at his disposal. By taking up some duty for aiding the mission of Krishna's dear devotee. When you hear how Srila Prabhupada labored so much to keep this mission going, then you aspire, let me do something to assist. You take up some kind of duty. According to your capacity, your lifestyle is different. A single person, married person, but still something should be there. And you cling to it. That will bring you up on the bhakti ladder. There's the duty to hear the holy name, the duty to immerse yourself in Srila Prabhupada's books. Otherwise, you'll be weak. There's no doubt about it. That's the order. I remember a devotee here asked Srila Prabhupada in Melbourne, "Well, isn't it so that the holy name is all we need? So why the talk about reading? The holy name is everything, isn't it?" And Srila Prabhupada replied, "The spiritual master has ordered that you read his books. So if you don't do that, you're offending the holy name. You're neglecting the order of the guru. So what kind of chanting is that?" So, if we combine the hearing and chanting with the taking up of some duty for satisfying the desires of the founder Acharya, the previous Acharyas, Lord Chaitanya. And then, by executing that duty, the anarthas go away. Because one has to be humble, one has to be tolerant. You're always praying to Krishna, should I assert myself in this situation, or should I stand back? Or you're always starting to consider Krishna's interest. Would it be better if I asserted myself? Would it be better if I said, no, this is the way to do it, I'm in charge here? Or is it better to, well, whatever you say, Prabhus. You're always thinking like that. That means you're thinking about Krishna. How can I do this service better? Maybe it's making garlands, mopping a floor, whatever. Still you're thinking, I've got to be there at the temple at such and such time. I have a duty. Not, if I don't show up, so what? Someone else will do it. What's the big deal? I'd like someone treating you like that. If I don't show up, big deal. You wouldn't like anyone treating you like that, but this is what we do sometimes to Christians. Plenty of devotees out there, they can do it. This is a bad personal attitude. So have some duty. Be attached to it. And then you'll notice the anarthas start to go away. Huh? Anything else? Yes.
So yesterday we had the choice to be served up by a yoga woman from Mumbai. As a devotee, we personally take me in my own celebration. So how do we understand? Are we going that way? Actually, we're working.
Good point. So you're asking about something I was going to mention, but I forgot. The ripe mango and the unripe mango. Very simple but profound example given by Srila Prabhupada. Actually, devotional service rendered within the material world and in the spiritual is the same thing. They're just different stages of maturity. Just like a mango is a mango, whether it's ripe or unripe. Similarly, bhakti, service rendered to Krishna, is bhakti, whether in the material world or in the spiritual. It's just a question of ripeness. If you let the mango become ripe, then you have a mature, tasty mango. In the beginning, when it's unripe, it's not very tasty. Still, it's a mango. And in time, the sweetness will become very apparent. So yes, we are doing devotional service. But if we're on an immature stage, if we're in an immature stage, you won't get all that sweetness that you'll get when you're in the mature stage. Still, you have the mango. You have the devotional service without a doubt. The main mistake I particularly see Western devotees make is they don't have enough patience in bhakti. You ask any older devotee who's been around trying to serve Krishna faithfully for 30 years or more, the process does work if you give it time. Without a doubt, the process works. But the main mistake, particularly Western devotees make, is, I've been here 2 years. I've been here 10 years. Now, where's my rag? What's happening? Why 5 years? Why 10 years? Why not your whole life? Your whole life is not very long, you know? What's wrong with using your whole life as a platform for developing attachment to the holy name, attachment for devotional service? What's wrong with that? You see, because in the Western world, there's no culture that fosters spiritual patience, spiritual determination, spiritual endurance. What is it that people think about when it comes to endurance, patience, and determination? Economic development. That's the real mark of a determined, patient person. When you hear the story of someone who was poor and struggled and then became rich, that inspires a person. Yeah, that's where it's really at. When you hear about someone who maybe 20, 30 years labored in poverty and then suddenly struck it rich, people become inspired by that. The intelligent thing to do is to be inspired by the development of devotional service to the Lord, which will become mature and ripe like a mango if you just give it time. But the mind is so agitated these days. We do ourselves in so quickly with lust, with envy, with anger, and out the door we go. If you just make peace with yourself, saying, this is what I'm going to be doing the rest of my life. My whole life is a career for developing attachment to Krishna's glories, developing attachment to duty and Krishna's service. Make peace with yourself by accepting that and march forward with your career in Krishna consciousness. Then you'll see things happen. But the main problem with so many of our devotees is this impatience. They can't visualize their whole life in Krishna consciousness. Often they need help. They need career counseling. They have no idea of their longevity, their future in Krishna consciousness. But ask any devotee who's managed to go on serving Krishna decade after decade. They'll tell you the process works. It's amazing. It does work. If you just stick it out. But can we see ourselves sticking it out? What are our plans for sticking it out? Those are the critical questions. Anything else? Hare Krishna. Thank you very much.